Welcome to this podcast number 865. This episode brought to you by Audible. You probably like audiobooks. I mean, it's you can't have a book in your face all the time reading words with your eyes. Sometimes you need to read a book with your ears, Katie. Or from magazines or newspaper publishers or information providers, not just books. And that you can do when you catch up all on how new books. Use Audible for all of these types of reading consumption endeavors. Is that a fair statement?
I think so.
What are you listening to on Audible?
Right now, I'm listening to The Handmaiden's Tale before the show comes out.
Nice.
Yeah.
Just to get a little.
Yeah, I wanted to like read or listen to the book before the show.
That's really interesting because I always wonder where people fall on that. Like, oh, if I haven't read the book, do I watch the show?
Yeah.
First? Or so nothing's. Do I watch the show so then the book isn't spoiled? Or
well,
is it better
I started
to read
a bit ago because like the show doesn't come out to the end of this month, so
gotcha.
I wanted to make sure I had enough time.
Well, just for listeners, Audible is offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/nerdist. Start your free trial today. Do you have anything on the Nerdist Community Corkboard that you would like to share?
I do. I got a couple things. First of all, if you live in LA and you want to go to a comedy show and help shelter pets, Home Dog LA is having their second annual comedy show to benefit their charity that works with pet owners in LA who need help in LA shelters to save the lives of shelter pets. This year's show is May 20th at Candela Taco Bar and Lounge, and it features Sarah Silverman, Nick Kroll, Natasha Leggero, Ahmed Barucha, and more. You can find tickets and info at punchlines4paws.brownpapertickets.com. And the four is the number four, or homedogla.org.
Excellent. What a lineup.
Yeah. And then one more thing. This was really great. This person wrote in, Devin Ellen Son. Wrote in, I want to see if you can plug my mother's event to your community corkboard. She is doing a flamenco festival in Ithaca, New York at the end of April. Some of the top flamenco artists from Spain are performing two shows on April 29th at the State Theater. And there will be master classes for the dance, singing, guitar playing, and it sounds like a lot of fun. So if you go to Aura C Flamenco, that's AHORASIFLAMENCO.com. You can find out tickets and info.
Absolutely fantastic, Katie Levine. Thank you so much for being a valuable member of this team here over at the Nerdist Podcast. Dori Shafir is our guest on the show today, and Dori is married to Matt Myra.
Who?
This guy that used to hang out here all the time.
He sucks.
Thick beard. I think he's from Philadelphia. Where is he from? Oh my God, he'd be so.
I'm from Lowell.
Matt's from Lowell. But yeah, Matt came too, and Dori has a book called Startup, which is a novel. It is in stores April 25th, so next week, and you should absolutely buy it. Dori is brilliant. Dori is a solid, brilliant human being. I'm so glad she came into Matt's life. He is an incredibly lucky individual to have been able to marry Dori. But I adore her. I adore her. And you should absolutely buy her book. So I'm glad that we actually had her in. I don't think she's never been on the podcast before.
No, she hasn't.
So, and they also have a separate podcast because they're going through IVF right now called Matt and Dori's Excellent Adventure. And they're over two dozen episodes in, I believe. And it's just been about the process for them. And they're fantastic. Fantastic.
What a great couple.
So I'm glad we got to have her on. And then old tag along, Matt, it almost kind of felt like a hostful. The three of us talking about stuff. So Startup in stores next week, April 25th. Grab it. Pick it up. This episode also brought to you by Casper. Obsessively engineered mattresses at shockingly fair prices. If you're holding something and you read the prizes, you will be so shocked they will fall out. The things you're holding will fall out of your hands from the shock that will reverberate through your molecules. That's supportive memory foam. It is award-winning sleep surface that with just the right sink, just the right amount of bounce, you're going to try it 100 nights free in your own home. 100. If you don't love it, they will pick it up. They will refund you everything because they understand the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit. But I feel like you're not going to want to return it. It would be
no,
insane.
It's so
you're
comfy.
Not going to
return it.
Free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. Over 20,000 reviews, an average of 4.8 stars. It has quickly become the internet's favorite mattress. So get $50 toward any mattress purchased by visiting casper.com/nerdist. Use the offer code NERDIST. Terms and conditions apply. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 865 with Dori Shafir.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We'll be right back. Anyway, our guest on the podcast today is Dor Schaefer. Am I saying that right?
Schaefer, actually.
Schaefer. The bane of your existence.
Indeed.
It's Dori Schaefer.
Very good.
Thank you for being here on the podcast known as Nerdist. Are you familiar with the podcast at all?
I've heard it once or twice.
Dori is married to Matthew Mira.
I answer to both.
Isn't it nice that that doesn't happen anymore, does it?
It still happens.
Really?
Like, I mean, I've had like two EPs on the Goldbergs who second to last day were like, said Mira, and I was like,
guys,
all right.
Been here for months.
Oh, I've had people tell me like how big fans they are of Matt and then say
Mira.
Mira. It's a name you see, you don't hear the name, you see it, you know, see it in print.
I'm just glad that Matt finally has the job that matches his aesthetic. He looks like he's always looked like a staff writer with the baseball hat,
sure,
and then the beard for a long time and the glasses. And he finally had, like, you finally
dress for the job you want, Chris.
That's exactly
that's what they always say.
But we're here to talk about your book, Dori, Startup, a novel, which is an incredible accomplishment. It is not fun or easy to write a book. It is certainly not fun or easy when you have to. How were your notes? Did you get notes and edits? Did you have to go through?
I did get notes and edits. They weren't as extensive as I thought they were going to be, which was like both good and bad.
Yeah.
Good in the sense that it was like, oh, okay, well, you think this is like pretty decent already.
Yeah.
And bad in the sense of like, wait, are you sure? You know, like, don't you think this could be so much better?
So you were giving them notes on the notes they gave you?
Well, when I turned in my revision after I did get my notes, my editor was like, wow, you really revised this.
That's incredible.
And I was like, yeah, I did.
Because that's not a fun part of the process.
No, I mean, I actually didn't. The revising part was not as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I had a couple friends at work read it. I mean, I paid them to read it because they were both like 27. And I was like, please make sure that I've accurately represented the lives of people in their 20s in my book. Thank you.
Gotcha. So a lot of it is just them whining about how they're not rich and famous without actually doing any work.
That was the number one
good
edit they
had for
me.
I just want to make sure that that's a whole list. That's pages 19 through 138. But I don't think you've ever been on the podcast before, have you? This is the first time.
This is the first time.
So Dori, for anyone listening, although I'm sure you probably know since you're fans of Matt Mira, is that Dori is married to Matt. Uh-huh. Somehow, some sort of charitable chamber of her heart said, I need to take in this stray writer and somehow clean him up and make him...
I was much cleaner before.
But it was really amazing because when you met Matt, there was definitely a positive shift in his personality. And then the first time that I met you, I was like, wow, Dory's really cool.
Thanks,
How
Chris.
Did you do that? How'd you make that happen?
Tricked her on Tinder, bro.
Yeah. But it was a Tinder success story.
It was a Tinder success story, which I feel like has given some people false hope. Like, people have been like, you guys met on Tinder, so I'm going to stay on Tinder. And then, like, I see them a couple weeks later, and they're like, Tinder is so depressing.
You're more the outlier than the example.
I would like to be the example. Like, I would love for everyone to find true love on Tinder. But I don't know that that is always what happens.
I mean, as far as I know, that's how it works.
That's exactly how
it
works.
That's how it...
You sign up for Twitter.
Tinder, I meant.
Tinder.
Yep.
And then immediately you fall in love with the first person you go out with.
That was exactly...
Done.
That was exactly
now,
how it works.
I had gone out with a lot of non-Mats.
So a lot of Jonas? What's that? That's only the two types of people I understand.
Ooh, do we get to talk about Jonah because he's not here?
He's not. You can talk about him whenever you want.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I had been dating. I'd moved to LA and I was dating for about a year before I met Matt. I mean, not like all the time, but like, you know, pretty consistently.
I was legitimately afraid to really go out, and I never did online dating. I never did any of the app dating. I'd heard so many horror stories about, you know, it all of a sudden just something happening and it turning really bad really fast, or just you never hear from people, or
yeah.
And that to me, it just felt like, oh, this just feels like a fruitless enterprise because I get really, you know, I would get really, oh, I met someone, that's really fun. And then you don't hear, right. What did I do? Like, yeah. I just don't, that doesn't feel good.
I mean, it does, yeah. It. I think it can bring out the worst in people. All that being said, I never had a horror story, but I had a lot of just like, meh.
Right.
You know?
Like, and then she ended up with, meh, Myra.
And here we are.
What was the thing that you sort of learned from that whole year of online dating?
Well, I think I had been in denial about it being a numbers game, and I put that in scare quotes. But there is something to like going out with a bunch of people, and you do kind of figure out a little bit more, I think, like what you like mm-hmm. and who you're into. And, you know, you would meet people, or I would meet people, and I'd be like, oh, they're like almost, if they didn't like have XYZ. And, you know, so that you sort of like start to think in that way a little bit.
So what happened? So when with Matt, what was it? Was it you got, because I know you guys connected right away, because Matt said, I met someone on Tinder, and I was like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And he goes, no, it was really great. She was really awesome. I mean, he immediately reported very positively and said, he's like, I don't know. I mean, and he seemed very dumbstruck by them. I'm like, I don't know what happened, if this is how it's supposed to work, if it's weird, but I met someone and it was great.
Yep.
Well, his first message to me on Tinder started with, I've never done this before. Like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. And I rolled my eyes. And because,
he's just being honest.
Yeah. Because, like, I had gotten tons of messages like that where people were like, oh, I don't know if I'm doing this right. And you're just like, oh.
And then a dong picture. Am I doing this right?
Right, exactly. So I was just sort of like, oh, another guy who's just like, oh, here I am. But then
that
I like
kind of me though.
Oh, yeah. Here I am.
But then I don't know. There was just something about him that made me think, well, maybe he's like telling the truth. And I responded, and then the rest is history.
I wonder how many left-handed guitars that guy has.
Yeah,
I bet it's a lot.
That was on my checklist.
Did I have like any guitar? There was no good photo of me with a guitar.
There was. There's a picture of you holding a guitar.
All right.
Oh, the big question is, did you enjoy Dave Matthews previously to dating Matt Myra, and now do you hate Dave Matthews?
No, I mocked Dave Matthews mercilessly before I met Matt. My brother is into Dave Matthews, and I was like, I am too cool for Dave Matthews. Mm-hmm. And when Matt and I started dating, I remember like very early in our relationship, I was at his house and I saw his like, he had gotten like some kind of like special like photo album or something from the warehouse.
What they had sent me was
for like being in this fan club for 20 years.
Oh yeah, he has like a low number in the fan club
it was,
too.
Was it 20? No, it's 15. 20
okay,
will be next.
Sorry, it was 15.
So, get it right, Dory.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they sent was like every year with your membership fee they send like usually
how much do you pay for this?
$30 a year, but it lets me get tickets before they go on sale to the public. That's why I've had it since 1998.
Okay.
So the warehouse officially launched in January 99. I joined in December of 98.
Chris, you really opened a can of worms.
And that can of worms is Dave Matthews. What's your member number?
2527.
2527.
But I don't know. I feel like I can't be the 2,572nd person to join it. I feel like I have to be earlier than that. Although there was a whole process of like, I want to do this. Mom, I need a credit card.
Right.
Because I was, how old was I? 98. 15.
Oh, my God.
So, anyway, to that point, they every year, like, and the longer you're in, that you get these swaggier things. So they sent this, what looked like a photo album with the Dave Matthews logo on it, Warehouse 15, it said on it, and inside it were all these sleeves for you to stick your ticket stubs in.
Sure.
And that was sitting on my coffee table.
And all your
table.
Ticket stubs are in there. Are you into anything as much as he's into Dave Matthews?
No, Matt is just Matt is a more obsessive person than I am.
Right.
In general, and in fact, I think this like bothers him
that you're not as obsessive about stuff.
Doesn't I mean it's not that like you not being obsessive bothers me. It's just that I sometimes our cultural touchstones are so like off that I just go like when I was saying that you should be sure to have your pet spayed or neutered.
She didn't know the Bob Barker reference?
Correct.
And then my sister texted us this morning and was like, the reason Dory doesn't know the Bob Barker reference is because she never faked sick to stay home and watch The Price is Right, whereas my sister was like, I did all the time. And then I realized my sister and Matt are both youngest children. Mm.
Do you know who really never knew that Bob Barker?
Who?
The guy whose Doberman bit you.
Oh, my God.
Because he was not
spayed
or neutered.
Bob Barker, I bet, would like to have a word with him.
Is it ironic that that's a great name for a dog and he was saying, have your pet spayed or neutered?
Bob Barker is a great name for a dog.
Or I guess that's more of a coincidence. I feel like you'd be a stickler for this sort of thing. I feel like, and I make this mistake a lot, people interchange ironic and coincidental. Mm. They'll go, isn't it ironic that his last name is Barker and he talks about dogs? No, that's coincidental. I don't know if it's ironic. Is it ironic or is it coincidental?
Wouldn't it be ironic if his last name was Barker and he talked about cats?
Maybe. I don't know.
That would be irony.
You know who wouldn't know? Alanis Morissette. Here she is, everyone. But I am so excited for your book because I remember the process. I know you had to sequester yourself.
I did.
Basically.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, Dory had to go to
She ran to Vegas.
Ran to Vegas.
Killed me inside.
Right. Well, because she can go there responsibly.
Well, sure.
That's true.
How long were you? At what point did you feel like you needed to get away and be alone and have to focus?
So I started it in January of 2015.
Okay.
And the first chunk of time that I took to like be alone and focus was that July. I have a friend whose family has a house in Santa Fe who very generously said I could stay at their house for 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Which was awesome.
Were they there?
No, no.
Oh, good.
They were like, you may use the house. Like,
it's the beauty of oil money.
Mm, good.
We're not there. And that was the first time that I like really sort of hunkered down. And then I subsequently took trips to – I went to Joshua Tree for a few days, which I found not – I was not super productive in Joshua Tree, I'll be honest.
Because you wanted to stare at nature?
You know – I felt like weirdly lonely there. I was there alone in a cabin, kind of an isolated cabin. It was a little creepy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I was like, ooh, this would be a good place to be with a friend.
Right. It definitely, when I think of Joshua Tree, I think of Snoopy's like ratty uncle or whatever. Who was that one sort of scraggly Snoopy dog? Who he pops up every once in a while, and you're like, he lives in Joshua Tree.
Yeah, yeah, I mean...
Katie, can you find any information on this dog that I hope is not a phantom dog that I created?
I don't remember this at all, so...
Snoopy has, like, an uncle or a cousin.
Scrappy.
No, you're thinking of Scooby-Doo. Snoopy.
Oh, Snoop-Pike. Scooby.
No.
Yeah, so that was like, and you know, I think I'd been seduced by people's pictures on Instagram.
Sure.
Because they were always posting these like very beautiful, bright, nature-filled, sunsetty, dream catcher pictures of Joshua Tree.
Bono was right. You know, Joshua Tree is just where it's at. Oh, did you find it? Yeah, it's the one with the little mustache.
Oh, that guy. Yeah.
It has their names, Andy, Marbles, Olaf, and Spike.
Might be Spike. I'm not 100% sure.
Sounds like an Olaf, though, really.
Right.
Could be an Olaf, too.
I think it's Spike. I think you're right.
Yeah.
But then I spent 4 days in Vegas and was very productive there.
Did you? Because you don't really gamble, do you?
I play blackjack.
You do?
I do, yeah.
How does it not... I couldn't play after I quit drinking because I just became acutely aware of how many times the house was winning.
Yeah.
Even though you were playing the odds.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I guess I'm like pretty good at cutting myself off. And I would like work most of the day. I would, you know, eat something, maybe go to the gym. I would sit by the pool and work. Great. And then at night I would play blackjack for like 2 or 3 hours.
You may have been the only person writing a book at that Vegas pool.
I think I was.
Well, who is it? Doesn't someone run off to Vegas all the time?
Yeah, I actually have a couple friends who are writers, who like novelists who also love writing in Vegas.
That's really interesting. It's almost the creative equivalent of leaving the TV on to fall asleep.
Yeah.
It's like it's funny that Joshua Tree was too much of a vacuum and Vegas was like the I mean, the literal opposite in every way. Yes. Although both are equally isolating.
And in a desert, yeah.
And in a desert.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. There is this sort of like ambient noise on all the time. And also, like, if you want to see people at any time, they are there.
There they are. Yeah. It's almost like you're almost like using the energy of, and then trying to filter it
totally.
In this book. So let's go back a ways so that people can kind of get to know you and your backstory. This person who has been such a part of the Nerdist family that the audience knows so little about at this point. So you are also from Massachusetts?
I am. I'm from Brookline, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston.
And what is the vibe of Brookline? Is it fancy? Is it fancy?
Yeah.
Matt thinks it's fancier than it is.
Because I'm from Lowell.
It has the word low in it.
We're from the other side. We're from opposite sides of the tracks.
I mean, at least when I was growing up, it was very like mixed socioeconomically. Now,
so 100 millionaires and just millionaires?
No, there were like housing projects and there was rent control there, which no longer exists there. So like there were people there who were living in like very cheap apartments. And,
okay.
I think they did away with rent control, so that doesn't exist anymore. And now it's like super expensive to live there.
But it's like the people who are from Brookline, the Kennedys, Conan, Hodgman.
Got it.
Michael Dukakis.
Got it. So when you were, did you always want to be a writer? What were you?
I always wanted to be a writer. I think I always wanted to be a journalist. And in fact,
and
I am a journalist.
Yeah, and you are.
But I was always reading and writing as a kid. Always reading, like always had books on my bed that I was just reading all the time. And
were you a social kid?
Yeah, I was a social kid. Like I had a lot of friends, but I was also like deeply into books.
So at what point where'd you go to college?
I went to Penn.
You went to Penn.
Philadelphia. Mm-hmm.
And majored in?
English and history.
You majored in English and history.
Mm-hmm.
So when did BuzzFeed, because you worked for BuzzFeed since the beginning.
They hired a lot of people who do journalism. Mm-hmm. I started there in February 2012. So, yeah. It's been like almost 5 years.
Are you still there? Did you just take a break?
No, I'm still there. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I took a couple months off to finish the book, but I am still there. I went back.
So what do you think about – you know, BuzzFeed is such an interesting animal because it permeates so much digital culture and part of it, I mean, like, it really is seeming to become, like, a real news source. But I think people still – I mean, we make fun of it on At Midnight all the time in the sort of, like, listicles.
Yeah, totally.
Top 10 Disney princesses that look like eggs or whatever, you know.
I'll write that down.
So, you know, I would really love to – and then we'll get into startup. But I really love to hear how BuzzFeed evolved and what was the mission statement and – did it stay on course or did you feel like, oh, you know, we kind of drive traffic?
She also worked at Gawker.
Did you really?
I did.
You worked at Gawker?
Yeah.
What was that? Because Gawker was sort of a weird.
The early days of Gawker.
When they were just like fucking people over?
Yeah.
I mean, it was, well, I mean, it, you know, like that kind of, listen, that, no, I mean, I hope this doesn't come off negatively, but that was sort of the birth of clickbait journalism in a way. Gawker, like, you won't believe what this person did, you know? Don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, I hear what you're saying. but I think at least in its beginnings, Gawker was so obsessed with just chronicling the lives of a very particular corner of the world, which was like Manhattan and media. And then it expanded, you know, after a few years. But in its like origins, it was a snarky media blog.
But did they not go out of their way to like dig up stuff and throw it out there
and try
to start, you know?
Yeah. And they also did, they had this feature called Gawker Stalker where people would send in celebrity sightings. I remember they started before people had smartphones. So there wasn't – and they started before TMZ. Like they started before a lot of the things that we kind of like take for granted in this celebrity culture world. And so at the time, Gawker Stalker was like very controversial. It was like, you know, people could not believe that Gawker was saying, you know, I'm at such and such restaurant and John Travolta is here or whatever. And they
right.
would text it to someone at Gawker and
right.
we would, you know, someone would post it. Of course, now it's like if you're on Instagram, you know, like it's just so different now.
Right.
So it's just funny to think like what was scandalous at the time.
But it's interesting that that really accelerated the speed of tabloid of that sort of tabloid section of our culture. You know, when before, you know, I'm sure it had to roll in. Maybe there was a tip line.
Yeah.
But now it's just
totally.
Like it's coming at the yeah. speed of.
Yeah, for sure. And then so I started there in like fall of 2006.
Wow.
And TMZ had just launched the year before. And I think they really took a lot of like Gawker's thunder when it came to celebrity stuff because Gawker just couldn't compete
right.
with TMZ's resources. But yeah, when I was there, my coworker, Emily, went on CNN. And for some reason, I think it was supposed to be
Kimmel.
Larry King, but Kimmel was subbing for him. And he like ripped into her about Gawker Stalker.
I remember that.
Still on the internet.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And I seem to remember she didn't really have an answer
no,
for
she I mean she had started like 2 weeks earlier.
Oh, no.
And she was 24 and
right.
like had no training and wasn't expecting this at all and you know was having to answer for this whole apparatus that she had not really
right.
started. But it was like hugely embarrassing for her. And Kimmel was like you could tell he was like legitimately angry about it.
Right. Because if I remember correctly, it wasn't some of his argument. It was like, you're putting people's lives in
yeah.
danger
yeah.
by telling people where they are.
Yes.
And, you know, like, so, yeah, I guess I do understand that argument.
Totally.
But also hearing that she had only just started there and was sort
yeah.
of like.
And she wasn't even supposed to do it. Someone else was supposed to do it. And then at the last minute, like, they were sick or something. And our boss was like, Emily, can you just do this TV hit?
It'll come and go.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll never.
Right. And she was like, okay. And then, of course.
11 years later.
Yeah. It's like the
still,
thing.
It's still on the internet.
Yeah.
So how did that affect what was going on over there at that time? Did that strengthen the resolve of Gawker? Or was there any voice there going, hey, maybe this is not the best thing to be doing?
No.
What was your thought process?
Well, I was covering media. Like, I wasn't doing Gawker Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this is kind of like a fun feature. I was so outside of, like, the celebrity world
gotcha.
At all that it – and also, I understood Kimmel's point. At the time, to me, it seemed harmless, in part because usually it was not real time. Like, there had been a couple times when it was pretty quick, but usually there was a delay.
Right.
And, yeah. And again, it's just, like, so funny to think about now, like, you know, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, like fans are so in tune with where their people are at all times.
Right.
That, you know, the idea that Gawker Stalker was the only place you could go to like find out where someone was is like kind of crazy now.
I mean, I guess, yeah, now it really is the responsibility of, you know, it's your responsibility as a public figure to. If you don't want someone to know where you are, don't post it on Instagram
right.
when you're there.
Yeah.
Just like,
maybe don't geotag it.
Wait a day.
Yeah.
Wait a couple hours until you've gone someplace else.
Exactly.
Yeah. But at the time, I think it was probably just more about people not really having a choice about it.
Totally.
And being like, shit.
Totally.
But it also gets really tricky. Where it gets really mucked up is that, you know, the Kardashian types of the world who are feeding
mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'm going to be at Kitson,
right.
you know, on Robertson.
Totally. They want to be in.
So it just all gets kind of muddled up because
yeah.
I think, you know, the people who – there are people who really want it. And then I think there are people who start the machine and then kind of regret turning it on.
Right.
And then there are other people who just don't want the machine, but because they're in the thing, it's like, well, sorry, this machine's already been started.
Yeah.
And if you want to do this, you got to be a part of this
totally.
Thing. And that's kind of how it is.
Yeah.
But what were you covering in media specifically?
I was covering like media gossip.
Gotcha.
So it was very niche.
Yeah.
But at the time was something that was like very important to Gawker. But Gawker was like was always very contrarian. So something like the Kimmel thing was just going to, like, they were just going to double down.
Sure.
You know, that was, no one there was going to be like, oh, he really got us.
Right.
You know?
Till Hulk Hogan came along.
Well, yeah, but I mean, even with that, you saw, obviously I was long gone at that point, but, you know, even with that, like, they thought they were going to win pretty much until the very end. And that was just sort of, I think, like, emblematic of the way they thought about things.
Right. So it was a very insulated way of, you know, like, we're so up our own butts, who's going to stop us? Because we're, you know, we
well,
have...
It was more that they saw themselves as, like, the underdog speaking truth to power, even when they were not the underdogs anymore.
Right.
Which is, like, a dangerous place to be.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because I think a lot of where we've come as a culture is, you know, it's all just shouting. And, you know, even I find that even people who speak out, like, against bullying are kind of become bullies. You know, there's a lot. And you go, yeah, you know, you're just shouting at people and telling them to go fuck themselves.
Right.
I know, but I'm justified. Well, that's what bullies think. Bullies always think they're justified.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, in this age where everyone's just sort of shouting at each other, how do we have conversations anymore? And is it wrong to want a digital experience? I mean, like, am I expecting a shark to walk on land? You know what I mean? Am I expecting something that isn't
possible?
That isn't what it is. But it just seems like everything's so elevated, and the attention getting. It's like, well, when you shout, you get attention, and people pay attention. And so, why would it occur to anyone to have a conversation if you don't? You know, I just wonder how. It's something I think about all the time. How much do people really want to solve problems, and how much do they just want to shout because it feels good to yell and take the moral high ground on
stuff? I don't know. It's hard to tell, because sometimes the people who are just shouting think that, like, they genuinely think they are solving problems.
Right.
So,
are you super involved with social media, or do you are you sort of lightly involved?
I'm like moderate. I would call myself moderately involved. Like, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Those are kind of my big three. Like, I dabbled in Snapchat, and I think I'm just too old. Like, my friends were not really using it. I did not find it that interesting. It was like I had to, like, remind myself, like, oh, you should post something on Snapchat. It wasn't something that I was doing organically. And so I still have it on my phone, but I, like, almost never use it.
Yeah.
But I really like Instagram. Like, Instagram is probably my favorite social network.
Mm-hmm.
I really, like, I think the community on there is nicer. I like that it's just pretty much just photos. I like Instagram stories. Like, I really like Instagram. Twitter, like, is Twitter. You know?
Right.
It's like, it can be real shitty. I try not to get in fights with people. And I don't typically write stuff that gets me trolled, except there have been a couple times where people – I don't remember – what was that thing that I was writing about where Little Miss Righty came after me? I don't even remember what it was.
I don't – oh, was it your – interview with
with Lindy West, that's right. Yeah, there's this feminist writer named Lindy West who used to write a Jezebel, and she writes a lot about, like, body positivity and fat shaming, and she's taken on trolls. And this guy, this horrible story where this guy had impersonated her dead dad.
Oh my God, I remember.
Do you remember this? Yeah, and she did a This American Life episode about it, because she ended up confronting him.
And then he crumbled,
yes,
right?
Yes, he apologized.
Was like, I'm sorry,
yes.
I was having a weird, yes.
So anyway, so she wrote a book last year that's really great called Shrill. It's a book of essays, and I'd interviewed her for BuzzFeed. She has a lot of people who hate her, and so people were, like, tweeting insane things at me because I'd interviewed her. Including someone with the handle at Lil Miss Righty.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the few times that people have, like, really
come
after
me. Yeah, I think they were
me.
Upset about, in the piece that you didn't mention that she blocked some people.
Oh, yeah, because she had this, she was saying all this stuff about how, like, sometimes it's okay to engage with trolls, and, you know, because she did that with the guy who was impersonating her dad. And then people were like, but she blocks people. And they kind of, like, lost their minds about that.
That was the thing they picked up on in the article.
What's wrong with blocking people?
I don't. They think that if you say that you confront trolls, then you shouldn't be allowed to block anybody.
Anyone. That you should therefore have to engage with every single troll.
There's no middle ground. It's just all or nothing?
Yes.
Well, I think that's just something that they just want to get mad at some
point. Oh, yeah. 100%.
But it was going for... It went for two or three days. It was crazy. Other than when I got into it after Brexit, it was the most trolly of Twitter experiences I had seen.
Yeah, but I think, you know, this idea of just saying the absolute worst thing you can just to get someone's attention or just to try to rattle someone. I mean, it's, you know, you'd think I would have thicker skin after having been on the internet since 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I still just feel – I feel bad because people go, why does it affect you? And I go, well, I'm not a fucking sociopath.
Right.
You know,
totally.
I'm a human being.
Totally.
And I still – my brain formed in a world where when you said something to someone, you had to be accountable for it.
Yeah.
And so when you say something to someone, you mean it. I think a lot of people now go, oh, it's just the internet. It doesn't really mean anything. Like, well, but it kind of does mean something.
Right.
And, you know, if I feel like I would be an empty shell of a person if nothing ever affected me.
Totally.
But I just feel bad for humanity. I feel bad, like, why would you think – because when my dad died, someone came after me and were – like literally the day of his funeral.
Jesus.
Were just like making – haha, did you get a call from your dad today?
Oh, my God.
Oh, he's dead. You know, like that. And I was so, like, I felt like I got punched in the chest.
Yeah, of course.
And it's not even directly because of what they're saying, but it was more the sadness for humanity of, like, why would you ever think that was an accept? What is so wrong in your life?
Exactly.
That what series of events has occurred that make you think that it's okay to treat another human being that way? And that was literally one of the only times where I was like, I'm going to offer the internet $25,000 to tell me who this person is, and I'm going to fly, and I'm going to, you know, like, I can't fight, so I don't know what I thought I was going to do. But it was just that, like, you motherfucker, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I ended up just blocking the person and not engaging them because there was no point to it. But,
but
I do wonder, and I'd love to hear your take on the idea of outrage peddling in the sense of, you know, it seems to me, and I mentioned it a few times on the podcast, and no one ever really talks about it, but I think it's a real social epidemic that is being driven by the news media of spotting something. Oh, some people got upset about this. You know, we have to post 50 articles a day. Let's post a news story about how someone was offended by something they heard or saw. And then we'll just – and it's always the same thing. You know, outrage always in the title. Probably drives traffic. And then it's 5 example tweets. And then, you know, no word back yet. And then the comment threads are always filled with – and I just feel like it's not – no one ever calls the news media after. Like, it's not altruism that you're telling people about this just to try to make the world a better place.
Right.
You are, for commercial reasons – making people upset so that they will come to your site and generating a thing that would have not really bothered anyone if it just sort of went away. Do you agree with that, or do you think that's not the right way to look at it?
I don't totally agree with that. I think it's complicated. I think one of the things about some of the outrage on the internet is that the people who are outraged are people who typically have not had a voice in the world, like people of color and women and gay people. And so sometimes they are outraged about things that they were probably like really pissed off about before. They just didn't have a way of expressing it.
Well, I'm not talking about things that are important to humanity. I'm talking about, I feel like I see the word outrage a million times a day on my Google News feed.
Right. So it's kind of lost its power.
And I just feel like it's a tactic. It's a clickbait tactic now more than it is this is going to make society a better place. Because the articles never say anything about, well, how do we move forward from here, or how do we gain an understanding? Or if someone did say something really stupid, instead of trying to destroy them, what if we found out, what did they mean it? Did they not mean it? Are they really a fucking dick?
Right.
Should we, you know, it's like, it always just like outrage to destruction. And then, and I feel like the, it's, we're losing the conversation in the midst, but I really,
so I just Googled outrage and then went to news to see what we could come up with. Here's my first one that came up. Viewers are outraged that Channel 5 chose to air graphic Watership Down on Easter Sunday.
Okay, this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about, because this is not a this is not a human rights issue, which I think people should be outraged over human rights issues. This is a ridiculous thing. There are probably tweets in there of people who
This is full of tweets.
Yeah.
So here's the first tweet. It's from someone named Louise Westy. This has this tweet has one favorite. Who the hell puts Watership Down on Easter Sunday? That's their first example. Channel 5 are absolutely savage showing Watership Down on Easter
Savage!
Sunday. That's one way to get trending, I guess. So far, for Easter Sunday, they're showing Watership Down. Did they watch the movie first, or did they see bunnies and thought, for kids?
Oh, God. I mean, that's kind of fun.
A happy Easter to all. Just remember, though, Watership Down is not an Easter movie. So
this is sort of what I'm talking about, is
the controversial decision, which angered viewers last year, has once again caused a furor on Twitter.
Well, I think one of the problems is that so many sites now have someone whose job is social news. Like, this is a job to look on social media and, like, see what people are talking about. And that is a thing that gets reported on. And then it kind of creates its own cycle, like, more people find out about it because you're writing about it, and then more people are tweeting about it, so it becomes more of a thing. So, like, the – what's that expression? Like, the – something's eating its tail.
The snake is eating
its
tail?
Yeah, the snake is eating its tail a little bit. So, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't – I agree that there's probably a lot of those articles that don't need to get written.
Right. I mean, it's not – like, that's not saving anyone's life.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not – so that's why I want to make the clear distinction between what you were talking about, which, again, I believe are human rights issues, and yes, the internet has given a lot of people a voice that didn't have a voice before, versus, you know, we should tear it, we should take down Channel 5 for airing Watership Down, you know?
Right.
And I feel like there's no distinction between what's really vital, and it just all goes in the same bin.
Yeah, you know? I think that's the problem, is like, like, the word outrage has just lost all meaning.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's true.
And how long were you at Gawker?
I was at Gawker for 10 months. It felt like longer.
How come?
Because it was, at the time, it was very much like, you know, you had to do, I had to do 6 posts a day. It Jesus. Was, like, very kind of, like, machine-y. I worked from home most of the time, and I was, like, chained to my desk, essentially. And it was a lot of aggregation at the time. Like, I did some original reporting, but it was mostly, like, reporting on what – just writing about what someone else had already written. And so that was, like, kind of boring.
Yeah, news aggregation is – yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that's what Nerdist was in the beginning, was really just kind of – because it's – you just need content, so you're aggregating news, but then you're sourcing it back.
Exactly.
You know, I always made sure to source it back. Because there's just only so many original stories you can write in a day, because there are just only so many hours in the day.
And then the other thing that, like, really got draining and was kind of why I couldn't even stay for a year there was because everything had to have kind of a snarky or negative take.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't be really excited about anything.
Right.
And that got to be, like, I was like, this is not really me. Like, I felt like I was sort of adopting this persona of a Gawker writer. And that was exhausting.
Yeah. That's the other thing, too, is that, like, this tone of negativity has somehow become the authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that irritates me about it is that I don't think it's authentic anymore. And so when you try to call people out for it, they go, oh, I guess you just can't handle truth. And it's like, no, but this is their brand.
Right.
They're just staying on brand. Whether or not they mean that, I don't know, but it feels like this particular site has just fallen into its groove, and they know that their audience likes to see that kind of snark. And so I don't know if it's authentic anymore. I don't think it's any more or less authentic than if they were excited about something.
Totally.
I think they should just be authentically excited or authentically not excited about things.
Right, right. So that was something that was like, I didn't go straight from Gawker to BuzzFeed. I had a bunch of jobs in between, but like when I got to BuzzFeed, it was very refreshing because they are not haters.
Right.
And, you know, you could be enthusiastic about things. You're rewarded for being enthusiastic about things. So that was a nice change.
What was the mission statement at BuzzFeed when you started? Because now it's like it's such a behemoth.
God, the mission statement when I started, I don't remember, but I do remember that in our job postings, we said no haters, and we got a lot of shit for that.
Now that's ironic.
Yes, exactly. because we weren't interested in hiring people who just had a knee-jerk negative reaction to everything. Like, we wanted people who were enthusiastic and passionate about stuff. And I believe it was actually Gawker who made fun of us for this aspect of our job postings. I don't think the job postings say that anymore, but they did for a while.
Yeah. And so how did it grow so exponentially in such a short amount of time?
Well, the short answer is money. But when I started there, they had just gotten, I think it was like $15 million of venture capital funding. And I think that was like their second or third round.
But
of,
for what? You know, because I
to
think...
To build a news operation.
To build a news operation. Because a lot of times when I see like some sort of a digital enterprise and I go, well, they've raised $70 million. And I was like, I feel like, but for what? I mean, like if you really look under the hood, what is it? Is it just brand valuation or is it like... Because I can't imagine you can do $70 million in banner ads. Like maybe you can, you know, but like, so what is it that's really being... what is it that's really being sold?
So before, like in the period before I started, BuzzFeed didn't have that much original reporting. It was basically just like, here's what's cool on the internet right now. And like what's trending on the internet. And that was mostly, and they did some like funny posts and they were like starting to experiment with viral stuff and see how people shared stuff. And then Jonah Peretti decided that he wanted to start an original journalism operation. And so he hired Ben Smith, who is editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News now, and Ben hired me. And we hired a whole bunch of people to do journalism. And it just kept growing and growing. Like every few months, there would be a new initiative. Like, we're going to hire foreign correspondents and we're going to start a business desk. And we're like, and every time I was like, wow, surely this will be the last thing that we do. And every time I was like, nope, like we're going to keep going. And that is like kind of still true. Like it slowed down a little bit, but now there's over 1,500 people who work
at
BuzzFeed.
That's insane. How did it – what was the sort of – what do you think was the secret to the success?
I think that we understood the internet better than a lot of other sites did and had a lot of people who had kind of grown up on the internet working for us. Like we hired a lot of people in their 20s to just make stuff. Mm-hmm. And put a lot of trust in them where I think other sites did not, at least initially.
Sure.
I think Jonah also like very early on understood the power of Facebook in particular to drive traffic.
Sure.
And he also like has a deep understanding of why people share things and kind of tried to steer people in the direction of making stuff that people would share. And so that was like huge and made us so big. And then I think another thing is we started like going into markets that our competitors had not gone into. We started doing a lot of Spanish language content. Like I just feel like Jonah has always kind of pushed the boundaries. And then he was also one of the first publishers to say like, you know what? People aren't going to be going to like www.buzzfeed.com that much anymore. Like, they're going to be getting BuzzFeed content on Snapchat. They're going to be getting BuzzFeed content on Facebook videos, on YouTube, on like all these other platforms. And so he was like one of the early people to recognize that and built out teams to do that. He also like got that video was going to be huge, like very early.
Oh, wow. Because I wonder if there's still, I mean, do you think they sort of wince a little bit when people are like, oh, the listicle site? And they're like, oh, we actually do a lot of stuff.
You know, we were like pretty sensitive about that at first. Like when we had started the news operation, I would say for the first year or two, like when we were publishing like these really, you know, deep, like long stories, and people would just be like, oh, they're the cat video site. But now it's sort of like, we almost, I think, you know, I don't want to speak for everyone there, but at least for me, I'm sort of like, oh, that's sad for you that you think that's all that we do.
Right.
You know?
Right. So what was the motivation to write a book about startup?
So when I started writing the book, I'm currently a full-time writer at BuzzFeed now. But at the time, I was editing and managing people. I was hardly writing at all. And I really missed writing. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to start my own project. It's just going to be my own thing. It's not going to have anything to do with BuzzFeed. And, you know, if it never sees the light of day, you know, if no one ever sees it, then fine, whatever.
Those are usually the best projects because those are the ones that you're passionate about.
Totally. So it was like the end of December 2014. I was writing my New Year's resolutions and I was like, I'm going to write every day for a month. Just in the morning, and I'm just gonna like see what happens.
Your own personal NaNoWriMo?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you ever read The Artist's Way, like,
right.
She, you know, she says to do morning pages, and I didn't write it in like longhand, but I did wake up every morning and like sit down and write. And at the end of the month, I had 60 pages, and I was like, whoa, like, how'd that happen? And then I showed it to a friend, and I showed it to my agent. And they were both like, oh, you should keep going with this. And I was like, really? You sure? And yeah, then they liked it. And so it just kind of like snowballed from there.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
I mean, that really is just, I mean, that's why, I mean, I was being sincere when I said those are usually the best ideas, because they're the ones that you know, especially if you think you're just doing something for yourself, then you don't ever think about, what's everyone going to say?
Totally.
They're going to say, you just do it because you like it. And then before you know it, you're so passionate about it that it just absorbs a lot of your time and energy, more than if you're punching a clock somewhere where you're like, I gotta go work for those people and then I gotta do that job over there. But
right.
Then I come home and then I get to do the thing I really, really, really want to do.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, that was definitely like the genesis of it. And then, like, once I got 100 pages in, I was like, okay, I got to finish this thing.
It's too far. It's tipped.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's tipped.
I did feel
point.
Like I had, like, reached this tipping point.
Are you eager to do another book anytime soon, or did this?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do another book. Like, I just feel like the last few months have been crazy, and now I'm just so focused on getting this book out that I haven't really started to think about another book, but I would like to write another book.
Are you going to adapt this book into a television show or a movie?
I mean, I would love to. I am obviously the most biased person to say this, but I think it would make a great TV show. And Matt agrees.
I agree. And, you know, it's very page turnery. It's very, it's just every character is fleshed out in a way where you're like, oh, I know who this person is, or I know a person like this, or, you know, everyone is sort of relatable.
Were you sharing this with him along the way?
I wouldn't read it. I was like, when you're done is when I'll read it.
Okay.
Also, he was afraid it would be bad.
Well, there
no,
was a little bit of
seriously,
that.
I mean, he was.
He was afraid that he was going to have to be like, honey, it's great.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a little of that. There was also a little bit of like, I write drafts of things and they're awful and I know that. And I just, you know, when you get it to a place where you're like, this is the book, then I would read it.
But then you didn't.
Not before then. It took me quite a while. But when I finally cracked it open, the galley, I... It just like It's so quick. So quick. That's the only book I've read in the last 6 months.
That's true.
Over and over and over again.
Oh, Chris, I can't put it down.
How's the Excellent Adventure podcast going? How's the Excellent Adventure?
The podcast is going great. We've been doing it every week. I think we've done 26 episodes.
Yeah, we've done 26 weeks of us talking about trying to have a child through science, and hearing from a lot of other people who are doing it in different ways. It's fascinating. You don't think about, when you hear IVF, you usually probably just think, oh, that's when there's some infertility between a couple. You never think about the other sides of it, where it could be, two married men that want to have a child, married women that want to have a child, a single man that wants to have a child, a single woman that wants to have a child on her own. And you never really think about all these other people that have to walk through these same hallways as you, trying desperately because you just want another being to care for. It's really so that part of the podcast, I think, has been the most interesting to me.
Is there a certain, like, what has been the, what, was there a debate between, like, well, should we adopt or really go through this whole process? You know, because I'm sure it must be hard on you. I mean, I'm sure it must be physically hard.
Oh, yeah. It's, you have to inject yourself with drugs for 2 weeks, like hormonal drugs. So they kind of make you crazy. And then they retrieve eggs from you, which is surgery, essentially. Like, you go under.
Oh, wow.
And then you have to wait and see, like, how many of them fertilize and then how many of them are growing. And there's just a lot of waiting involved in IVF.
Mm-hmm.
And then even once you have embryos, then there's, like, a whole other step to transfer them. And then sometimes that doesn't work. Like, we did a transfer that didn't work. So now we're kind of back to – we're not back to square one exactly. We're back to, like, square three or something, because we have two embryos that are, like, ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But because my book stuff is all happening, my doctor was like, I think we should wait till after the book comes out.
Because it's hard, stress affects our body.
And also travel, like, you're not supposed to be traveling, especially through different time zones.
Oh, so don't go on a book tour right after? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, basically, I'm about to embark on all the things that you should not be doing when trying to do IVF. So my doctor was just like, we'll just wait till we're kind of past that.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, it's hard too when you're the husband. You feel so, I'm so helpless. I don't have to do, all I do is jerk off in a room. That's, like, literally it.
I'm glad I got to picture
literally
that.
Literally all. Well, like you haven't before, Chris.
Well, how do you think I jerk off? I'm not even trying to make a baby.
You go the pouring water.
Oh, I just think about Matt with his jeans down on his Converse and that Red Sox hat.
I have Converse.
I don't know. I'm not.
Air Force Ones, bro.
Okay.
This is getting weird.
Do you jerk off into a red pair of socks?
I probably have at some point. That's all the male has to do. So really, it's just like you have to be aware of everything that she's going through just so you can sort of at least put yourself in a headspace where, like, we're in this together and, like, I know that you have to do this. So whenever I could be home to inject her, I would come home and help her with the injections. And it's just – it's so hard, too. And, like, when you're working a lot – like, I was working on the Goldberg, so I was – it was tough. Like, the day that we found out that the transfer didn't work, I was sitting around a fucking writer's table just, like, getting the news as we were working through lunch.
Right.
To figure out how to make Jeff Garland funny.
Right.
I'm kidding. Jeff's very funny.
So the short side of it is that it's really been hardest on you, Matt. Is
that, no. I'm saying, if that's what it came off as,
I'm just teasing
you. It's just like she has to go through all this.
I think I understand what you mean from the point of the person that you love more than anyone else in the world is having a difficult time and you can't really do anything to help.
Yeah.
So what is something, what did you guys establish in terms of, and maybe this is for other people who are going for IVF, but what is something that a mate can do who is not the one who's going through the whole process? Like, what is the best way the significant other can be supportive?
I think like patience is really important because, you know, you when you're doing it, you're already feeling like anxious and sensitive in general, and then all the hormones that you're putting in your body like make you even more anxious and sensitive. Sure. So, you know, if I say something that in a normal world, like Matt would be like upset about or something, just him not kind of like rising to the bait, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah. Like he was a very like calming influence.
Matt?
Yes.
Myra.
Yes.
This Matt Myra?
Yes. He's very good at calming me down.
He is. Matt's a rock.
Yeah.
I'm here to bounce, you know. I'm just your sounding board. Both of you guys, you know.
And also like showing up. Like even though Matt was, especially the last round, he was super busy at work, but he would talk to his boss and say, you know, my wife has an appointment at 11 a.m., like not the most convenient time for him to leave the writer's room. But he would and come to the appointment with me. And so that was like, that meant a lot to me that he was like really making an effort to show up.
Also helped that it's very close to Sony.
Yeah. I mean, seriously.
I mean, let's be realistic about Los Angeles and how things work.
I mean, if it was in the Valley, you might have been on your own.
Oh, yeah.
That's
no.
going to be an extra hour
Culver
out of my
City
day.
To the Valley at that hour? I mean, it's impossible.
I can't even imagine.
I mean, there's no public transportation system that's good here. I don't know how you would do it.
It's insane.
It would be a real
You'd have to have a helicopter.
Even like the 45 seconds you have to be on the 405 in Culver to get from my place of work to our clinic, it was real roll of the dice.
Yeah.
Every time. It would just be like, what the fuck am I going to hit?
Hey, this is sort of a personal question, but I think a very good one for people who are also going through this, but how do you keep the romance part around sex when...
They don't. I mean, it's like... No, it's also, Bo has not helped, our dog, with that part. We got Bo right. Did we get Bo right when we started doing IVF?
Yeah,
it's been an issue. I could not tell you how to keep it. I love my wife dearly, and we're very affectionate towards each other. But like, it's just so stressful for both of us.
And you're not allowed to have sex.
And you can't have sex in a cycle, and a cycle lasts weeks. So it's just it's.
So do you have advice for people who are going through it, like how to stay sane through the whole process?
I think talking about it has really helped me, open about it.
You mean doing the podcast?
Doing the podcast, but also just in general, like with friends. Even before we started the podcast, I had started to be open about it on social media, and so many people reached out to me who I had no idea had gone through IVF. Like, not people I was super close with, but people who I was, like, friendly with.
Yeah.
Who I, like, knew obviously had kids. And they were like, oh, you know, I did IVF for Tommy or whatever.
Right.
And that was, like, that was a real eye-opener for me because I realized how secretive the process is for so many people, and I think that makes people feel really isolated,
and it just helps demystify the process.
Totally.
Too.
Yeah, I mean, when I would talk about it at poker, it would turn out like half the table were going to the same
that
clinic.
Was actually that was the thing that it like I think that was the thing that inspired me to be more open about it was Matt talking about it at poker because he would like text me and be like, hey, like, you know, this guy's wife is going to our clinic and, you know, this guy's wife is going through it too. And this guy, and I was like, whoa, that's like, there's only 7 or 8 people at this table.
A table of nine.
And like 4 of them are going through IVF. So that has been like a relief for me to just sort of feel like, I don't, because the first round I wasn't talking about it with anyone and it felt like a burden.
Sure. Well, that, and now we're talking about social media being used for a positive cause.
Indeed.
Which is to help people feel not alone, to actually connect people, to actually create conversation. And I think it is, whenever someone is open about a struggle that they're going through, I always feel like, well, that's the right thing to do because you know that it may be hard, but you know that other people who, you know, don't have, you know, like you said, who don't have a voice or don't have, maybe don't have an understanding circle of friends.
Exactly.
Allows them to go, oh my God, I'm not alone or crazy or I feel that too. I mean, it's like when social media works as a legitimate support group, then I go, okay, well, it's worth it because that actually does help people.
Yeah.
And it legitimately changes people's lives. I mean, I know like these episodes that you're doing, and I think I maybe said this to you when you first started doing it. I said, this actually will change people's lives because it will open it up as a possibility to them if people are on the fence about it or if people are, you know, if it's wrecking someone's relationship and they hear this and they go, oh, okay, you know what? It's this thing and not us necessarily.
Totally.
So we can get through this. Okay.
It helped a lot. Like after when we found out my sperm was so dumb, when I was talking about it on this podcast.
Is it like the little Homers bumping into each other?
Just, dum, dum, dum. And there's not that many of them. And, you know, when I talked about that on this podcast, it was people would tweet at me or whatever and just like coming out of the woodwork going like, oh, me too. And I was like, oh, well, I mean, why fucking talk about it? Why aren't you talking
especially
about it?
Especially men don't talk about it. Yeah. And so that was like a very powerful thing for me to see after you guys talked about it at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Seeing all the people tweeting at Matt, like, thanks, man. You know, I'm so glad you talked about this. Like, and I was like, wow, like men really don't talk about this.
Well,
and, you know, it's like, they don't want to admit it, and they don't have the same support, I think, that women do. And so that's been, like, a nice thing for me to see. Like, I personally love that men and women listen to our podcast.
Well, so much of our identities, and, you know, I don't know how nature nurture this is, but so much of our identities is focused around our genitals, you know, like around our dicks and our balls. And
that's
so,
why Bo gets so angry.
Right, exactly. So when something isn't working the way we think it should be working, it really is a crushing blow to our ego because we feel like I'm not a man. That's how you define a man, and I guess I'm not. And so it really is, you know, it depending on how you were raised, you know, it can really be like crippling for guys because they don't have anything else to hang on to. It's like, no, you're more than that. You know, yes, it's, you know, it's a rough period that you're going through, but you're not abnormal or broken or ruined or anything. And so that's why I do think it's great to, you know, when people talk about that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, in almost every episode, someone writes in with like, they're like, it's some aside that one of us has made, and they're like, that thing you said about whatever, you know, people identify with so much of what we're saying in a way that I think we're not even like aware of as we're saying it.
Right.
But like, you know, like you were saying it, like, I think it does bring comfort to people. And the other thing that has been really powerful for me to see is the number of people listening who aren't going through IVF and who say, oh, this has like made me understand infertility and IVF a lot more. And they say it's like made them more sympathetic friends or family members to, you know, their friends and family members who are going through IVF. And so I just think the more like awareness there can be around it, the better. So I love that people who aren't going through IVF are listening to it also.
Yeah, plus we don't take it super seriously. We try to have fun and just be normal human beings having a conversation. And you know, sometimes I say things like, I want her to get a C-section because I want her to keep it tight down there.
Oh,
and then
Jesus
people
Christ.
Email like, why did you say that? You're an insane person. I'm like, God, they don't really understand me.
And then I just say, can you stop saying keep it tight down there, please?
But obviously, Dory knew this about you before she agreed to marry you.
Yes, but
because Matt, I don't remember you changing your personality when you guys were dating. So
no, she got well.
Did she get the full Matt?
That's it's interesting you say that. I was more ready to go along with things, but I am not. Like, she would make plans, and I would always be okay with these plans and be delighted to go see the whoever the fuck we were, wherever we were going. And
not Dave Matthews.
Not Dave Matthews. And you know, I slowly let the dragon out of the egg there when I was like, you know, I don't want to go anywhere.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
But we figured it out. We figured out how our life works, and we had, you know, the podcast has helped us immensely because we talk. We have a date to talk every Sunday night. We sit down and record the podcast.
I think that's great. I almost think people should do that even if they don't intend to put it out.
Totally. How often do you sit down, not you, but like one, you sit down with your partner and have an uninterrupted hour to hour and a half conversation with no TV and no phones, and like that doesn't really happen, just the two of you?
I think like a phantom podcast could help a lot of people's
totally.
Place in a relationship. I mean, like, I know, you know, when I had my dad on the podcast, I had no idea that it would be one of the most significant, and because I had never sat down and really just talked to him like a human being and dug around. I mean, you know, we talked on the phone all the time, but it was, and I'm sure like in relationships, hey, how was your day? Oh, good. How are you doing? Oh, good. You know, I was rough about this time. Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay. Well, let's, you know, let's watch a movie. Okay, great. You know, but really in depth, substantial conversation, which a podcast is somewhat of an interview situation.
Totally.
Even though I don't really think of it as interviews, but it's more of a structured conversation. And what better way to just like start digging in and really, even if you don't intend to ever put it out, what a great gift. You know, after my dad died, I was like, I can't believe I almost didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I have this forever now. This is the, like the one of the most significant conversations I have recorded. Like, even if people just saved it and were like, we're going to give this to our kids someday
so they
have a sense of who we are as people, I think it's an interesting, important thing to do.
Yeah, it's, I hadn't really thought about the longevity of it.
Yeah.
The fact that the whatever being we are creating while doing the podcast.
Oh, they're going to know that you earned them.
Yeah. So that and we now do a Saturday date night where, like, we go. She picks something, I pick something. And we have this like Saturday, Sunday situation, and the weekends are great. And that's how we survive in a marriage.
I think it's really smart because in the beginning, it's always easy because you're in that phase.
Don't need sleep.
And it's effortless. Yeah. It's effortless because you're so driven by the butterflies. You know, the butterflies are just like turning the wheels. And then as you get into a relationship, it probably seems... It's like, oh, but it doesn't feel spontaneous to schedule a thing. Yeah, but once you do it, you know, like
then you're
engaged in it, and that's the important part. And
sometimes I force spontaneity on her, where like, oh, we didn't like Saturday. We'd been going to like concerts on Saturday nights and like going, I don't know, other things we've done, you know, special dinners, so on and so forth, and then. We just, like, it got away from us because, like, we went on vacation and then we came back and went to a concert. And then this week we were like, oh, what are we doing? Let's go for a bike ride or something. And then I had to do a couple podcasts, so the daylight was gone.
Of course you did.
I did. And then I was like, well, let's just go for the patented spontaneous Matt Myra drive where we ended up in Hawthorne.
Sure.
And then ended up in, San Pedro. Like, we just drove, and it was kind of great to see. I was like, how far does La Brea go?
That is the most Matt Myra question. That makes so much sense to me that you said that.
Yeah.
That makes all the sense in the world.
And it was dusk, and we drove through down La Brea to, like, Inglewood and Hawthorne and... It was
Torrance.
And it was great.
Don't you go through like Holmby Hills and...
No.
Or is that more not that way. That's La Cienega. But like, it was like, I was just
like... We saw an abandoned mall.
Have you ever seen the Hawthorne Plaza?
No.
Oh, Christopher.
Are you going to go urban spelunking?
Pull it up.
You're going to go urban spelunking where you like go into an abandoned building and...
Well, it's like, so we have this fun... I think it's fun. When we're driving, I'm like, okay, you're the 21st century historian on this starship journey. We're driving, and anything that we see, we're like, we have like a question about like, what the fuck is this Hawthorne Plaza? It's enormous. And then she'll look it up, and then like she finds the Wikipedia article for it, and the fact that it's on abandonedmalls.com. It's
It's on deadmalls.com.
Oh, deadmalls.com. This is the inside of it. And it's just sitting in Hawthorne.
Did you go in?
No. It was very much gated up. And
my friend went to a drone flying contest that they did in there.
That's awesome. I'm pretty sure it was in
there. They've shot movies awesome. There. Like, yeah. there are scenes in, like, Minority Report that are in there and other...
Isn't it in Westworld?
Yes, it is in Westworld.
So they're going to... So we're like, she's like looking at the information, and it's like, oh, it's been approved to be bulldozed and turned into an outdoor grove-type place. Or like
with apartments,
market.
Yeah.
And like, you're just thinking, oh my God, it's like going to totally turn that street back around. And it's like, and they're already, it's cute. Like, Englewood and Hawthorne are like kind of great little towns. Like,
yeah.
But just to the fact that this sad place opened in 1974.
77, and it closed in 1999. So it's been sitting there for almost 20 years.
First of all, not that old for a mall.
Correct.
And second of all,
abandoned.
What the fuck?
40, how many acres? 46
acres.
40
acres or something. It's huge.
Abandoned. In Los Angeles.
Wait, hang on. I gotta pee really fast. Hold that
bar. He's gonna pee.
I'm sorry I had to do that. I wanted to... go pee in lieu of like just going enjoy your burrito and then just ending the podcast.
No, it's fine. We were talking about this restaurant we went to called Cannibal.
Oh, I've heard of this place.
Culver City, very good.
Yeah,
I was commenting on. I didn't drink, so like much like yourself, we would both be probably ordering a flat water and maybe I got a Diet Coke and they brought it out in a tiny glass bottle, which I hate.
No, you're not.
Don't like a tiny glass bottle. I want a fountain. To fill up my Diet Coke glass, and I want it to... If you're going to give me a bottle, mm-hmm. I don't want a 6-ounce bottle. It's ridiculous.
New rules!
I'm not on an airplane.
No bottles anymore, guys!
No tiny aluminum bottles or glass bottles.
He drinks it in like 2 sips.
I don't... I can't crazy. Tell you the last time I actually drank a soda, but mm-hmm. I always... I mean, I honestly... I can't even remember. It's been several years. Uh-huh. But I do think that... I prefer the bottle. I just like the taste of a... I just like the taste
of a
bottle.
You like it coming out of glass.
Yes.
To a can.
What?
To a can.
You prefer that
to... Oh, to a can. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I prefer it to any sort
really?
Of experience.
Now let's,
yeah.
let's step in the Wayback Machine. Okay?
Pew, 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 pew.
We're, let's say we're 17 years ago. And we're talking to Peter Hardwick.
I'm 4. Oh, okay. All right. No, I was definitely 4. Right.
17 years ago when he was 4. did you prefer the taste of beer or you just didn't care? Out of
I didn't care. I liked all of it differently. I had a very compartmentalized approach. You know, there were some times where I felt like, oh, I want a tall Sapporo bottle versus other times I want a frosty mug, but only certain types of beers tasted good in the frosty mug. The cheaper American beers, I feel like, taste better in a frosty mug. But I liked, you know, I liked Moretti or Sapporo or, you know, Budvar, which was Czechoslovakian Budvar. I prefer all those in bottles. So that was my approach back then. It just depended on what it was.
Understood. Well, my approach with soda, Diet Coke particularly. It's the only soda I have drank or drink. And I don't drink it anymore, really.
Jeez.
Only on vacation or at a restaurant where I'm having some bread.
Where do you fall in this issue? I mean, this is...
I don't drink soda.
Really hard-hitting. Me neither.
But I'm saying, like, they have these aluminum bottles, aluminum-shaped bottles.
Yeah,
I like
them.
I like those. But again, it's the amount of liquid they're giving you. That's too little for me.
Where did La Brea actually end?
It turns into Hawthorne Boulevard at some point when you're staying on it, unless I went the wrong way.
No, I think you're right.
But yeah, so there used to be a big aerospace industry in Hawthorne that was Grumman and
Howard Hughes.
Yeah, and Lockheed Martin all were over there. Like a lot of the components for the Apollo missions were built in Hawthorne. And it's just sad. Like, a lot of aerospace has moved out of there. So the town in the, like, 80s, right, we were reading?
Yeah.
That's sort of when the mall started to take a downturn.
What a fun idea, though, you guys. What a fun idea to just, like, you know, and it doesn't cost anything to do that, and you spend time together.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Dory.
Yes.
If I am ever privy to, like, NASA auctions. Is it better if I don't tell Matt about it, or is it better if I tell him about it?
Don't tell him, please.
Okay.
It's been an interesting time for us adjusting to this whole IVF costing a fuck ton per pop.
Do you feel like the cost, can the medical industry justify the cost, or you feel like it's just more like, well, this is what we can charge because if people want it that bad, they'll fucking pay it. Is it like that kind of a thing?
I mean, look, I don't really know. It seems exorbitant to me, but...
Isn't it like 25 grand every time you try?
Basically. And then the drugs, you know, if they're not covered by insurance, they're also another like $4,000 to $5,000.
Are they covered by insurance?
No.
No.
Generally not.
Some insurances have infertility coverage, but
do they approach it like elective surgery, for instance?
It's just not covered.
It's just not covered.
So it's super expensive. The only thing I will say is that now that we do the podcast, you know, we hear from people from all over the country and in different parts of the world, and there are parts of the country like where the cost of living is less, where IVF is also less,
mm-hmm.
and around the world it's also less. Now, look, I understand Los Angeles is an expensive city. I'm sure there's like parts of the cost that are like rent of the office, you know, like
sure.
stuff like that. But it does seem like a lot of money.
I can't imagine that the rent on Brentwood is cheap where we go. So
no,
it's like, yeah, you're like, really? It costs this much?
For reals?
Yeah.
This vial is $1,000? Is that what you're telling me? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. $1,000 for this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume just some of that is just part of the fucked up medical industry.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Totally.
Fully.
It's really fascinating. Like, you have to spend over 10% of your income to write off medical expenses on your taxes, and we got there. It's insane.
Oh my god,
it's fucking insane. So the but what's nice about the podcast is you hear from all these people. Sometimes you hear from people who are like, you know, I'm in Israel and it was free. I'm in England and I got it. It gets covered. I'm in Canada and some of it's covered. You know, it's just really interesting to hear from all of these different places. And if we still lived in Massachusetts, it would be covered.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So there's no way to establish residence in Massachusetts.
Well, there's a way, but the problem would be having to get out there. And to be out there while going through it would be a big pain in the ass. But I have friends, my friends Kevin and Kelly, they were living in Florida and had to start doing IVF, and they moved back to Massachusetts to get the IVF for free.
Holy shit.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
So where are you at today?
Today we're like nowhere. Like, we're in a holding pattern, essentially, because we're waiting for my book stuff to be over.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. And when is that?
So my book is out next week, April 25th.
You excited?
I'm very excited.
That's very exciting.
And I'm going on a book tour, so there's going to be a lot of just, like, travel and stuff happening for the next month or so. So I will pick up the IVF after that.
When you get back.
We're gonna test her endometrial lining when we get back.
That's the other hilarious thing, is like Matt knows all these terms now that he never knew before.
Yeah. Asked me fucking a year ago what that was. We're like, oh,
they didn't talk about it on Next Generation. It's not in his lexicon.
Exactly.
They're like, is that like a defensive scheme for the Steelers?
No.
Okay. So you know, we're gonna check, because we did a transfer that, you know, we did over Thanksgiving. It
didn't work.
It just didn't work. And
they don't know why.
We don't know why. We don't know if the window we went in was a little... So that being said, so like we didn't know if like the window of when we were implanting the embryo was right, what her lining was like at that point, so on and so forth, which just, for me, reinforces the miracle of birth. Like the miracle of that fucking sperm cell.
Literally.
Hitting that egg. Yeah. And becoming a splitting enough cells, becoming an embryo, attaching itself.
Do you just look at the Duggars and go, what the serious fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're a human pyramid scheme.
Sperm can that guy have?
I mean,
and how many eggs could that woman have?
I know.
I mean, is it? I've always been. I've never actually had to do that. Like, go into a doctor's office and, like, you know, crank one out for science. But what is the process of that like? I mean, how does it? Because obviously, it's, you know, the setting feels a little
it's terrible,
jarring.
It's
and then when you walk out, do you have to hand someone a beaker of your own
mayonnaise
and be like, I just made this. And you can't, I mean, do you make eye contact or is it weird?
I actually, when I drop it off, I say, coming in hot. And I put it on the, and I put it on the little place where they say.
That's my husband, everyone.
It's your problem now, Dory.
So, I mean, it's like, it's a very weird situation. You're holding a fucking container of hot jizz. It's just like, and you're like looking
fresh
around
out of the
like,
oven. Fresh out of the oven.
So you've nothing like. She has to go. Like, this is the crazy part to me. Is like, we have to go there in the morning. And when we're doing this, like when she does a retrieval, they need fresh sperm to try to fertilize the eggs. So she has to fucking get wheeled into her. She has to go under. There's a doctor working on her, a nurse. I literally have to walk into a room and hope I can find something to jerk off to. Like, I just walk
Golf in. Magazine? What is it?
You open the drawer. There's a variety of... I would say that the selection of porn at the clinic we go to is rough.
Do you want
to
touch any of it, though, really?
No, you don't. But I did do a little scan through the book just to see what it was doing before I was like, thank God I have the internet.
Right.
But it's a sad room. There's usually a toilet in there for some reason. There's usually a pleather chair that is rough.
Was it just...
Like one of those chairs that like, if you're in college and you saw it on the side of the street, you'd be like, no.
No.
That's not coming.
Not only am I not going to just sit on that, I'm definitely not going to jerk off on that chair.
So there's that. You like put down a little pad like you're a puppy trainer.
It seems like 1,000 other people have already jerked off on that chair.
Hundreds of thousands. Yeah. I can't even... One time we were fucking... It took forever because there was a guy in there.
Let's pick it up in there.
And like, it was like... I was waiting like an hour and a half. And I was like talking to the nurse. I was like, "What's going on?" Like, oh, there's a backup in there. And I finally see the guy come out of the room. And everyone knows what the guy's doing in there. But I finally see the guy come out of the room, and he looks like he has just fucking stormed the beach at Normandy. Like he is just like there's sweat on his brow. His polo shirt is like a little disheveled, and I don't know if he got one, but just like I have so much sympathy for that guy because it's like, you know what's happening in there. We all know what's happening in there. You're in there. I like try to get in and out in 10 minutes.
And the more you stress about it, the more difficult it becomes.
I'm sure.
You know what they should do is just come up with a series of settings for people like, this is an airplane lavatory. This is the dressing room.
We talked about this on the show where it's like...
At a Dillard's.
It's so funny because I talked about this and... All we do is like get people like saying, "Oh, the jerk off room at my place was terrible too," but then my favorite email we've gotten so far was from a lesbian couple that they were doing a turkey baster insemination. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had their friend coming over, and they asked me because they'd heard me complaining about the jerk off room. They asked me to set the table. Like, what is the setting?
What's your perfect jerk off room? Yeah. What's your perfect spank cave?
But they were like, what was it that like flipped me?
The ramekin.
Like, they wanted him to jerk off into a ramekin.
What?
And I was like, there's no. Ladies, I love you, but there's so many issues that come with getting a ramekin. You're like, okay, what's like. Was there a souffle in here at some point? Right. What will you throw it out afterwards? Right. Like that would just be in my head. I couldn't do it. So I was like, go to CVS, go to the pharmacy. You can get a urinal container, like a little urine test.
Don't you see what's developing here is that you guys There is a multi-million dollar industry if you create Fapperware, where it's basically just a certain type of
sharks.
I'm in. I'll give you $2.4 million for that deal.
I forget what their other questions were, but a lot of it, like what they were saying they were going to do, I was like, this is a setup for failure. I was like, here's what you do. Let him use a bedroom. Make sure there's a high internet speed. Tell him to bring his own fucking laptop.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not going to have to think about browser history or anything like that. He can just go do what he needs to do. If you want to light some candles for him, great. You really want to make it a time. I said, but please, if you're going to be home, go downstairs or as far away from the bedroom as you can and play very loud movie or music so that, like, you know that you can do it in quiet. Because, like, the room at the California Fertility Partners, where we go, is right next to the lab. And you're just hearing chit-chat about where they're fucking going for lunch, and I'm in here trying to make a child.
Did you see Game of Thrones last night?
Yeah, oh, man. That shit. So I was just like, you know, just play some. It's like, I was like, the ideal, for me, I think it's the ideal scenario, for jerking off and making a baby, and the ideal scenario for shitting aren't that far apart.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's just like, I just need me time.
Private.
I need no one else to hear this.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, Todd Glass used to have a funny joke about how he would love to have in a bathroom attendant that just plays the trumpet.
Just to block out
yeah,
the sound.
Yeah, it's like, of course, that's what you want to do. But so, yeah, that was my advice on their jerk. But that was like one of my favorite emails, that they were going to make their guy jerk off into a ramekin.
That, I'm glad that didn't work out
that
way.
Yeah. But we should hear from them again. We should ask
should
about
get a follow
that.
Up from
if
them.
It all worked out.
Yeah.
Well, I hope. How are you feeling emotionally? Have you just sort of put it all on hold to get through the book as well?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in my brain, there's not room for like working full time, IVF, book. Like something has to give, and right now the thing that's giving is IVF because I have to be thinking about my book.
Sure. So, what advice would you give? Like, what sort of quick advice would you give to other people who are?
Try to make like everything else going on in your life as like stress-free as possible. Like now is not the time to, in my opinion, like now is not the time to like start looking for another job or,
right.
you know,
move
or moving. Yeah, exactly. Like try to just have other things as much as you can, have other things in your life be calm.
Yeah.
Obviously that's not always possible, but like to the extent that you can, I think that's important.
And then lastly, how do you handle a Matt Myra on a daily basis? What is the if someone out there is looking to get their own Matt Myra?
Sure. You know, I think in all marriages, like you have to pick your battles.
Right.
And excuse me. And that's like something that I'm not always good at. And Matt sometimes makes it hard because sometimes he does things that annoy me. And I'm like, is this something I should get upset about? Or is this something I should just let go? And so, yeah, like we kind of try to figure out things to compromise, like date night.
Yeah. I mean, it turned into a thing of like, I never wanted to.
He never wanted to do anything.
Well, this is surprising to no one.
Yeah. I just wanted to be like, I work a lot. And like when I get home, I want to be home.
I know, but she works a lot too.
Yeah. And I was like, and I need attention.
She gets to walk our dog in the middle of the day. She works very close to our house. And sometimes she's like, nah, I don't know if I'm going to go in today. She can work from home. It's a beautiful thing that she has over there. So anyway, that's it's all compromise. And for me, it's not, I always de-escalate. Well, not always. I would say 95% of the time I try to de-escalate whatever the argument could be just by listening to her, hearing her, and being calm about it.
Well, there is a very important step in the process where your lizard brain starts to get activated, and then all of a sudden you're just arguing to argue.
Yeah, totally.
And it's like, well, this isn't – and you have to stop and take a breath and go, is this moving closer?
Right.
Are we going to understand each other by the time this is over, or are we just – you know, are we just going to get louder and we just going to like storm off and
totally.
Then nothing gets solved?
So Matt is actually very good at not letting it get to that place.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Thank you.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Too. If you want to hear more about this, you can check out Matt and Dory's Excellent Adventure, available on iTunes. Someday on Stitcher, when I get my shit together. I don't know.
Are you going to stop doing the podcast when you get pregnant?
You know.
We don't know.
We don't know. Like, there have been people who have emailed us and been like, I hope you guys keep doing it, like, when you get pregnant.
But it's just like, I don't want to, like, because it's a sensitive bunch, the bunch of people that are going through IVF, you know? And sometimes when they hear about someone having successful IVF, they get a little pissed off. So I just, it'd be interesting to figure out if that would be, like, a crazy trigger for people of, like, well, here's us.
Well, they could also just not listen, though. You know what I mean?
Or maybe we get a whole different audience. Like,
I think once you've sort of established your relationship and people like hearing you, I do think that it could evolve, you know, through the pregnancy.
I've been trying to get her to be a mommy blogger and to start doing unboxing videos on YouTube.
Sure.
Just really exploring the financial streams that could come from this $100,000
investment
we're
of
making.
Another guitar that you shouldn't have purchased. Oh, look at this one.
No. Mommy bloggers, it's got to be like bullshit for babies, right? That's what they unbox? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh God, I can't wait. Just
all the tweets.
Set her up and say, "Here's the camera. Go nuts."
Oh boy.
Get you a nice DSLR. We'll make sure we have good audio, and you'll be
wow. He's really
chippery
about this.
He's really Matt's very thorough.
She'd be a great mommy blogger.
If nothing else, Matt's very thorough.
Indeed.
Matt is incredibly thorough.
Hi.
Hey.
Matt was just Matt was doing that thing that sometimes guys do, which is massaging the shoulder of his wife, which I think is almost a, did I go too far?
Yeah.
Are you okay?
We still love each other,
just trying to see it, just trying to see how tense the shoulders are.
We're in love. We live together still.
See, Dory has removed and dropped her ring into a vat of acid.
Oh,
which
no!
She brought with her.
I was anticipating this moment.
Well,
the only thing I ever paid for out of pocket. Come on.
I love that you're in Matt's life. I think he's incredibly lucky to have you.
Thank
and
you,
I've always had such tremendous respect for you and I'm so incredibly excited and proud that you fucking wrote a book in the midst of everything else. It's hard to just write a book.
Thank you.
Just by itself is not an easy thing to do. But on top of everything else and you know, continuing to work.
And it's a novel. It's amazing.
Startup, a novel, which is... Oh, this podcast is going up tomorrow, so this is available next week.
It is available next week. You can still pre-order it, which is actually a really great way to help authors because all pre-orders get an account for your first week of sales.
And that's where you can make the New York Times bestseller list.
That is where you can make the New York Times bestseller list. All kinds of great things can happen, so... Yeah, it would be awesome.
And just a nickel pitch for the book for people who don't know what it's about.
It is about the tech world in New York City and a startup founder who gets caught in a scandal and a young tech reporter, a woman who uncovers the scandal and events unfold from there.
Excellent.
It's true.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Giving people a peek into the world of Matt Myra.
Oh, should we mention any of my appearances?
Are you doing
a fuck ton
I'm
of
doing
appearances.
A bunch of them. Can I?
You can say anything you want.
Okay, cool.
Promote anything you
All
want.
All right. So April 26th, Wednesday, I'll be at Housing Works in New York City. April 27th, I will be at Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn. April 30th, I will be at Print, a bookstore in Portland, Maine. May 1st, I will be at Trident Bookstore in Boston.
It's going to be wicked awesome.
And Matt will be there too. Thursday, May 4th, Skylight Books, Los Angeles, California. May 17th, Book People in Austin, May 30th, Palo Alto, Stanford University Bookstore.
By the way, all from memory, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you. And June 1st, I will be at Book Passage in San Francisco. So please come. It would be great to meet you.
I gave you a music bed because when I worked in radio, if you were ever like a music bed always... You know, just
during the plugs.
Yeah.
I heard it and I appreciated it.
Great. I'm sorry. That was impressive.
Thank you.
I honestly don't. We're like, where are you going to be? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's in my eye, Cal. I've lost the ability to retain information anymore. That's why I have this external hard drive that I carry everywhere.
Thank God teleprompters were invented, because your brain, if you had to memorize everything you have to say, would melt.
It's all off the top.
Oh, I mean,
talking about
Chris,
that?
What's you're a doing
teleprompt. What? I don't
even know. It's an invention I made up. It's in my jerk off
like
room.
A real thing. It's put a teleprompter in your jerk off room.
Over to you.
And send us your...
Coming in hot.
Top 10. BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed. Ready? BuzzFeed?
Oh, yeah.
10 celebrity jerk-off rooms.
Oh.
Send us your ideal jerk-off room.
Love it.
At Matt Myra.
That's like something I'd really like to get the Property Brothers involved in. Like if we went from fucking clinic to clinic remaking their jerk-off rooms, like even if it was a web series.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Because they are uniformly bad.
Yeah.
The jerk-off rooms are uniformly
they need
bad.
Us. It'd be like when John Taffer walks into a failing bar.
Right.
They would see me and the Property Brothers walk into their failing jerk-off room.
Jerk-off room rescue?
Sometimes it's an ambush. Might be someone in there.
Yep.
We don't know.
You have no idea.
That's the beauty. That's why people tune in.
You know, I think if we put down some velvet pillows to really rub against the skin, that's going to be a real value add.
Shiplap. It's from me, Shiplap.
Oh, that's from Fixer Upper. She loves
sure
Shiplap.
Sure
is. Loves Shiplap. Joanne
loves she Shiplap.
Ever. Oh, let's head to the silo. We're out of Shiplap. Let's head to the silo.
We're going to go to Wayfair.com for a good spank couch. A little spank sofa on Wayfair.com. You know, I really want it. It's just like going to the secondhand store to find like some vintage toilet.
God.
Guys, this is our idea.
Yeah, this is our
$1 million show.
Idea.
This is the $1 million idea. Should we call HGTV?
Maybe we talk to Fish Ladder, see what they can do with
it. We should talk. That's a very good idea. We'd have to produce it for AMC, though.
That's fine. They'd love it.
I feel like HGTV, if
you
it were
comic book men,
rooms,
then this jerk off room
wouldn't,
show.
It wouldn't be Home and Garden Television. It would be TV. Dory, I hope your book. I hope your book crushes.
Thank you, Chris.
So congratulations.
Thank
and,
you.
Thank you so much. And I'm now that I'm done shooting 24 wall episodes in 9-10 days.
Oh my God.
It was crazy for like, there was a week where it was like Talking Dead on Sunday at midnight, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, two episodes of Talking on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, The Wall, Sunday, back to Talking Dead. Like,
how are you alive?
You know, I don't know.
Do you have any vacation planned? At any point, you must have a hiatus coming up in May, probably, right?
But I'm going to host Red Nose Day in New York, so that's my hiatus. This hiatus was shooting The Wall from at midnight, and the next hiatus is Red Nose Day. But June,
yeah,
we're already trying to figure out where to go.
Right. We would recommend Paris.
Paris is nice, but I don't know if I want a vacation that I'm going to need to recover from by the time I get back. So anywhere that's more than 6 hours
totally.
Difference, it's like, oh, then you come back and you're tired.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, have fun in Vancouver, buddy.
Maybe Vancouver. Maybe we'll drive to Lake Tahoe drive.
Yeah. My next big drive, I want to see how fucking long Western is.
Good idea.
Have you ever, you know, you can see from the hills, you can see Western. It's just a straight shot into the
abyss. Yeah, bro.
I want to know what's down there. How far does Western go?
You're so adventurous.
I was like blown away. I was like, we're at 222nd Street.
Oh my God.
This is amazing.
He was blown away.
We used to live off 3rd Street.
I mean,
we're at 222nd.
I mean, I can't believe this, the adventurous side of Matt Myra. How are you not soups turned on right now, Dory?
That's part of our excellent adventure, guys.
How far does a Western go? Well, you better turn the car on and get home, because we're not going to find out, my friend.
Where we're going, we don't need a jerk.
Yes!
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.